Hello, I'm Barbara, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Barbara.
My sobriety date is November 15th, 1998, and that day was picked because I couldn't remember when I had my last drink, but I knew that it was in the beginning of the month, and it was before Thanksgiving, so my sponsor helped me pick that date. I've been sober, it'll be 8 years in November. As Billy said, I was born and raised in Richmond. I don't know if you've ever been there or been around, but I grew up in Lakeside, which is a little teeny tiny part of Richmond. I have a younger brother, and my parents were legally married. My father was an active alcoholic, and he was not very nice. So I grew up in a very chaotic household, and I learned how to handle chaos very well. I was very comfortable with things being chaotic. I was always the kid in school that made the good grades, that did what my dad wanted me to. I got very involved in sports and in clubs and did all that stuff. So on the outside, I looked really good. And my father, being the good alcoholic that he was very, he cared a lot about how you looked. It didn't matter what went on in here. It was just as long as you looked okay and you didn't look too screwed up, then everything was just great. So that was a great beginning for me being an alcoholic. It was a great foundation. Fell into it quite naturally. Growing up, I never really saw my dad drink. I just saw him drunk, so I saw kind of the end result. So I saw what that was like. I never saw him get to that point, which growing up was really very confusing to me. But when I was 12, we lived with my grandparents. As I said, the way I grew up was very chaotic, so my mom and dad always lived separate, which I think was a true blessing. And my grandfather had a bottle of Tanqueray gin that was underneath the cabinet. It was in the cabinet underneath the phone, and I found it one day when I was 12, and I don't know what it was that made me try it, but I took a sip, and I had never had alcohol before, and when I took it, it was like, all right, I like this, you know? And so my drinking career, I guess you could say, started at that point. I went through high school, and I think the first time that I ever got drunk, I was like a junior in high school, I guess, and I drank grain alcohol. See, I'm going to start things off right. I ain't going to mess with this other stuff down here. But I ran cross country, and I had one of my friends who was old enough to buy alcohol, and there was a little elementary school down the street from where I lived, and he bought it and hid it underneath the sign in the woods. So it didn't look suspicious at all that two young girls were in the woods going like this through stuff to try to find alcohol. And we went to a football game. And then the big thing to do was to go to McDonald's after the game. So we went there, and I got a large drink, which is now a medium. I got a large drink, and I poured out that much of it and filled the rest of it up with grain, alcohol. And I was very intoxicated and went back to my girlfriend's house and spent the night, and she lived right down the street from me, and I had the most god-awful bed spins. I was putting my foot on the floor, like, that really does anything, that I was putting my foot on the floor, because I was told that if you do that, it would help it stop, and it didn't, and woke up the next morning, didn't have a hangover. I thought, well, this ain't bad, all right, this is pretty good. So then, the next time that I remember drinking was I played on the softball team, and my softball coach bought us alcohol when we went camping. And one of the girls there had made up, she had mixed, I think it was like vodka and orange juice in the little bottles that you used to buy at like Tropicana. And she sold them to people for a dollar. And I don't really remember how many I had. The only thing I remember is I felt fine when I was sitting down, and when I got up off the picnic table, I went right on the ground. And I thought that was pretty cool. And I don't remember much of the rest of the night. Woke up again, didn't have a hangover. I thought, this was nice and bad. I ain't got no problem with this, right? Went to college. Drinking career pretty much took off through college. And what it did for me was that I felt like I fit in. I felt like I belonged. I felt normal. I didn't feel like I was so much of an outsider anymore. I didn't worry about all the stuff that was running through my brain. I just didn't worry about that stuff anymore. And all through college, it worked very well for me. I was one of the few people that I hung out with that could drink a lot. And the only reason I'm saying this is because it's part of my qualification for knowing that I have a problem with alcohol. Because when I went back And when I was looking through my first step, my first sponsor had me to write out what my story was. And I remember I was writing it, and it was like, I thought it was hysterical, you know. And I show it to my sponsor, and she's like, do you have any question that you're an alcoholic? I'm like, no, not really. Not now. I didn't. But I can remember being very young and never thinking I had a problem with alcohol, because I started out, I would only drink with my friends, but we never really talked about what it did for us. You know, they would talk about how drunk they got and how messed up they were. And then when I was in my probably early 20s, I started having blackouts. And I started drinking because I went to graduate school, because that's what I thought my parents wanted me to do, because I was very much a people pleaser. I'll do what makes you happy. And what ended up happening throughout my whole life is the more that I did that, the less that I even knew who I was. And then when I drank on top of it, it was even better, because I became whatever the heck I wanted to be at that point. So none of my friends ever really talked about it. And then in my early 20s, I couldn't get drunk anymore. I was like 21. I was at Radford. I was in graduate school. And I started drinking every day, pretty much. And still didn't think I had a problem, because I was still functioning. You know, I thought if you're an alcoholic, you've got to be living under a bridge, or you got to be like my dad, where he really didn't hold a job. He couldn't do much of anything. He was a real SOB. And that's what my vision of an alcoholic was. And I certainly was not like that. So therefore, I couldn't be one. But as I went through college, my drinking started happening every day. And then not only did it happen every day, but what also ended up happening is that it stopped working for me. I couldn't get to the point that I wanted to get at. It was like a dog chasing his tail, and I never got it again. I never got that first, you know, feeling of when I first started drinking again. So I just kept doing it. You know, it's that insane thinking, doing the same thing, expecting different results. That's exactly what I kept doing. I tried mixing things up. I tried drinking things differently. I tried drinking on different days. I tried doing all of this really crazy stuff. Or Billy and I were talking about at the meeting, before the meeting, the Alkalogic. And I was telling Billy I was listening to a tape of Steve Lee. And he told a story of Alkalogic, which obviously we can all relate to. This guy walks into a bar and he orders a beer. And then after he orders the beer, he orders shots. And he keeps drinking shot after shot. And after about 3 or 4 hours, the bartender walks up to him and said, I'm really kind of confused. You're drinking all these shots, but yet you've left this beer sitting here, and you haven't touched it. He said, well, I go to AA, and they tell me the first drink gets me drunk. You know? And to me, it just makes perfect sense, you know? And that's kind of, you know, the way that I was thinking at that time was really, in my early 20s, was really more of a survival thing. I hated myself. I hated the way that I felt about myself. I certainly didn't have any kind of, you know, spirituality about me. You know, growing up, my mom took me to different churches because she wanted my brother and I to experience different religions, because she grew up Jewish. But yet they still celebrated Christmas, because my grandmother was Christian and my grandfather was Jewish. And anyway, so we went to different churches. And when I was much younger, like early teens, I was very involved in church. I was like part of the youth council, and that really kept me so connected. And yet, that's the most connected I ever felt. But yet there was still something that was missing there. I still didn't feel a part of anything. I still felt like I was kind of looking in on my life. I didn't know how I felt, and when I had any kind of feelings, good, bad, or indifferent, I never liked it. I always wanted to stop it, because I never knew how to deal with it. Because growing up, you know, I saw my father act this way, my mom act this way, and I didn't want to do either one of those, which I obviously ended up doing. But I didn't know how to deal with any of that stuff, so I just didn't deal. You know, I just drank, and that was like that was my only coping skill that I had. And I can remember coming home from college going, oh my God, I have to be home for a month. What am I going to do? Well, of course, I drank. And I remember coming home the night before I was supposed to leave for college. I'd been home for like a month, and I came home, and I was really messed up, and came home and got in bed and was just woke up and feeling cotton mouth, just feeling really, really. My mom's like, "What's wrong?" And I looked at her, didn't even. I said, "I think I ate something that didn't agree with me. I don't feel good." So my mom just starts waiting on my hand and foot. "Oh, do you feel like going back to school?" Yeah, I think I need to go, but I don't really feel. Can I have some breakfast? And I, you know, and so she did. You know, that's exactly what she did. She took care of me and did what she was supposed to do. And of course, I never made mention of it. Still haven't made mention of it. Some things I don't really think she needs to know. But anyway, so I would go back to school, and I couldn't wait to get back there because I could drink. And I wouldn't have to answer to anybody. I wouldn't have to do anything. When I was at Radford, I lived with the girl who sold weed. Her name was also Barbara, so I got some very interesting phone calls. When I didn't even answer the phone anymore because, I just thought, why do it? And one night, you know, she had some paraphernalia laying around, and I wasn't used to going, "Who is it?" and looking in the door, you know, and I just said, "Come on in," and I thought she was going to tackle me on the floor because there was all this junk laying around. So that's the environment that I kind of lived in. So for me to come home three sheets to the wind was, nobody even batted an eye at that. You know, I came home one weekend, and they had gotten a picture out of my room, and they had done lines of coke on it because there was still residue all over it. You know, and I was so insulted. I was really very angry that they had done that. But yet, you know, I come home, you know, three sheets and throwing up everywhere and doing all this kind of stuff. So, you know, I guess it all evened out. But I don't know. But I was able to still appear to function, you know. So I kept thinking, as long as I appear to function, then that means I'm doing okay. I finished my year at Radford and had one of the first consequences of my drinking. I got a very lovely letter that was a page and a half long from the dean of the graduate school, basically saying, "Thank you, but no thank you. You really don't need to come back because your grades are basically so bad, there's nothing you can do to bring them up." And I was I was indignant. I was like going around everybody showing them this letter. Like, if I would have now get a letter like that, I'd burn it. I would not want anybody to know that. You know, but it was like, because I was the wronged one. Don't you understand? How can they kick me out? That doesn't even make sense. You know? I had that kind of ego that was there. So, never ever equating and making that connection of the drinking and going to class but not really being there and all that kind of stuff. So, I announced to my mother I was leaving school because I clearly was not invested in going anymore. It was just not what I wanted to do with my life anymore at all. And so I started working and ended up getting engaged and married to a guy that I had been friends with all through high school, and he was like a brother to me. And looking back, he was really kind of the ticket out. At the time, I did love him, what I thought was love. And we got married and had two children. And during that whole time, I rarely drank because I was so busy being a wife and having these two little kids that's what I thought my deal was supposed to be. So I didn't drink because it was like, well, I don't want to drink now. Why would I drink? Even though I still had all the craziness, the crazy thinking, the alcohol logic, the irrational fears, the anger, the frustration, all that was still going on inside of me, but yet I didn't drink. And then when that marriage ended, that's when I started drinking again because I remembered that's what worked before. So, but I'm going to control it this time. So what ended up happening is I would only drink one glass of wine, which turned into two, which turned into let's finish the bottle. And I would only do it. I had all these rules set up. I'm only going to do it at night after the kids go to bed. And then on the weekends, I can go out and do whatever the heck I want to do because the kids will be with their dad. So I had all these rules that were set up for when I could and could not drink. And then slowly those lines started getting blurred, and I had to make up new rules, you know. And I can remember sitting at the kitchen table alone by myself. I did not, at this point, I was drinking alone, like what they talk about eventually will happen. And I remember having the thought of, God, what would happen if one of the kids had to go to the hospital, the doctor, and I'm clearly not in any shape to drive? What would I do? And the next thought into my brain, without any stopping, said, but you've driven like this before, it'll be just fine. And I didn't think anything was wrong with that kind of thought process. Did not think anything was wrong with it. I used to drive like this when I was drinking, you know. Didn't think anything was wrong with it. You know? And when I got home, I'd be like, I'm glad I made it home. Not that I had to drive like this, but I'm glad I made it home. You know, all that kind of stuff. So, and my kids saw me take one drink the whole time this was going on. It was at my 30th birthday party. And my daughter came up to me, and she went to go grab my drink. And I said, you can't have that, honey. And she had never heard me say that before. Why not? I said, let's just go get you something you can have. And she's 15 now. When I divorced, she was 6, and my son was 3. And I'll get to that in a minute. Anyway, so my drinking started escalating at that point. The weekends that my kids were with their dad, I would go out with my friends and drink. And I had gone back to graduate school at this point. And I was out one night with my girlfriend. She lived in Fredericksburg, and she was spending the night with me. And I was supposed to be the designated driver. But the way that it turned out is that who was more sober equated to who the designated driver was. And it was probably about 3 o'clock in the morning, I guess. And we were driving home, and I was the one driving because I was more sober than her, which clearly was not true, but anyway. So I'm driving home, and I'm going across, I don't know if any of you are familiar with this, but Chippenham Parkway like turns into the Willie Bridge, and there's, at one point, there's like this really sharp curve, and I was driving a black car at the time. This is like at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I went over too far into one of those little drainage things and just hit the tire right and got a flat tire. And I was in the left-hand lane. So I just left my car there. Didn't put the flashers on. Didn't do anything. And there's nobody on the road at this point, at this time of night or morning. And so my girlfriend, Carmen, she goes, well, what are you going to do? And I said, well, we'll just get somebody to give us a ride somewhere. Like everybody is going to stop in Richmond at 3 o'clock in the morning to let somebody in their car. So a couple of cars had gone by, and I was getting very angry and very insulted that nobody would stop. And so this other car comes by, and I just walked in front of the car because they'll stop, right? And he did, not far from me, but he stopped. And I walked up to him, and I said, hi, I'm really sorry, but my car broke down. Can you please give me a ride? And he's looking at me like, you know, not forget that we were reeking of alcohol and that my girlfriend could barely stand up, and she's, like, leaning on my car because she could hardly walk. So we ended up, he gave us a ride, and we got a ride at this McDonald's. Well, they open apparently like at 4, I guess, to do whatever. So I walk up to the drive-up window, and I'm banging on the window, and nobody would let me in to use the phone. And I was like, we just need to use the phone. I was just so angry and so insulted, and they're looking at me like, yeah, right, like we're going to let you in here. So I go to a pay phone, and I called my husband at the time, and he was at home with my children. And I said, there was never a question of why aren't you at home at 4 o'clock in the freaking morning in bed. You know, there was never a question of that. It was, honey, you know, the car broke down. We had to hitch a ride up to McDonald's right up here on Huguenot. Can you please come up here and get us? And he said, sure. You know, and so my two children, who were like 4 and 2, 4 and 1, are in the back seat of the car, you know, and he takes me over to where my car is. Well, by this time, a policeman had come by and had put some little flashy things, you know, the little things around the car so nobody would run into it because it was in a curve. And it very easy, somebody could have just nailed the car and hurt themselves because of me being careless. And I got in the car, and when he got out, he said, you stay here. So I got out of the car, and my girlfriend Carmen went with him, who was much more intoxicated than me. And the guy and the cop says, well, was she driving the car? He said, no, my wife is, but she's all the way over there in the car with my kids. The cop never came over to me, never got a DUI, never had a consequence, never had anything, nothing. So I don't really remember. I guess the car got towed and got the car fixed. My husband at the time never questioned, where were you, what were you doing? I had it perfect for being a drunk. He never questioned where I was, what I was doing, why were you out so late, nothing. I had come home, had hangovers, was so sick, and he was like taking care of me just like my mom did. Never a question of, do you think you had too much to drink? Nothing. That was his own little denial world, I guess, he wanted to live in. But so when that marriage ended, my drinking really, really started escalating. I was going out more with my friends. And then when that whole episode with the car thing happened, that scared me, so I stopped doing that. Or if I did go out with them, I would have a drink like this. But I would have a drink and would not drink anymore because I didn't want that to happen again to me. So I started, I finished school at this point, I had gotten my first job. By the way, I'm a substance abuse therapist. And all the way through graduate school, I was drinking, by the way. And I had a lot of shame about that because, you know, I knew all about this, so therefore I couldn't be that. That was my line. That was my logic. And where I ended up doing my internship, I actually started working there. And it was a treatment center in Richmond that's still there now. The counselor that I used to work with has bought it, and they have a very good practice there. And she's also a member of AA. And at that time, Gail had probably about 8 or 9 years, I think, in the program. And she obviously was noticing things. And she said, well, have you ever thought of going to a meeting? And I'm like, well, how do I need to go to a meeting? I don't need to go. She said, okay. So we were sitting in, I was sitting in, another mini consequence that I had is I'm sitting in the treatment group that I'm running with a hangover. And that was the first sign that I'm like, this isn't right. Something is wrong with this. Something is very wrong with this. And I actually had to leave work that day. Because I felt so, I felt so bad. I mean, physically, not because of guilt, but physically because of my drinking the night before is why I had to leave work. So my work was suffering. You know, all of the things that I had supposedly prided myself on, I had been suffering from for a long time. And I got kicked out of school because of my drinking. I was hanging around people that I normally wouldn't be hanging around because of my drinking. I was living in a house where the FBI was watching during school because I didn't, first of all, didn't really care. Second of all, you know, the FBI was watching because my roommate was selling enough weed, you know, for the free world, you know. And I didn't think there was anything wrong with that because I wasn't smoking weed. Therefore, I didn't have a problem. Forget that I drank like a fish. It was irrelevant. So I would go into work, and I would start talking to Gail about some of the consequences and things that I had happened to me, and she would still offer for me to go to a meeting. And later I found that it was, you know, what we talk about is attraction rather than promotion, because that's exactly what she did. And one day I was at work, and there was something I was working on, and I was like, you know that chart they have where it goes down like this, and you talk about all the things that happen when you're drinking and you mark them off? And, like, if you get down to the bottom, that's, like, not good. I was, like, down at the bottom, and I'm sitting there going, oh, my God, I've promised that. And Gail said, well, you know, if you want to go to a meeting, just let me know. I was like, okay. I didn't go to a meeting. Finally, I decided one day I was going to go on my own, and I was so filled with shame about who I was and the profession I was working in. I didn't want anybody to know. It was okay for Gail to know, but I didn't want anybody else to know. God, I couldn't see any of my clients because they, oh my God, they would think I wasn't perfect. And so I went to a meeting in downtown Richmond on 5th and Main Street, where a lot of the suits go, you know, the bankers and the brokers and the lawyers and all that kind of stuff. And I went down there and picked up my white chip. And because that's what I thought I was supposed to do. I don't think at that time I really was convinced that I was an alcoholic or that I really even had a problem. Shortly after that, I went out with one of my girlfriends, and anger was always a really big trigger for me to drink because I would always drink at people. You know, like, I'm going to show you. You know, and they're like, I'm like the last thing on their mind, but they're all over my mind because I'm letting them rent space. And I would always drink at people, like, I'm going to show you, you know. And I was very upset. I was angry over a relationship. And I carried my white chip with me. And the waitress comes by, and Susan's like, do you mind if I have a drink? No, God, doesn't bother me at all. And I'm, like, you know, sitting there like this. And the waitress came by, and the first time she came by, I said, I told her, so let me, I want a Michelob. Yeah, just give me a Michelob. And Susan goes, can you drink? Sure. Yeah, I can grab one, right? And something happened, which was my higher power, but at that time, something weird happened. She came back again, and she goes, you know, we don't have any more. Do you want? I said, let me get O'Doul's. Let me just get the near beer stuff. And then before she left, I grabbed her hand. I said, just give me an iced tea. Because I had my white chip in my hand. And I didn't let it go the whole night, and I didn't drink. And I thought, something might be working. And in one of the meetings that I go to, there's a guy there, Patrick, who is, there are many words to describe him, but he started talking about, I've heard people say in the program about, you can drink when the white chip melts or any of this stuff, you know, and I kind of believe that. And Patrick's very good for giving statistics. We go to meetings, he gives all the statistics, which to me, I don't really care about because my thinking is like, if that ain't going to happen to me, I don't care how many statistics you give me. I don't care because if this program didn't work for me, then that means it didn't work for anybody, and that's a bunch of BS. And that's the way that my thinking was. But that night in that restaurant holding that white chip, I thought, you know, something might work. This might really work. But then I quickly kind of dismissed it. I started going to meetings, and I went, and I came in late and left early. I didn't talk to anybody because I knew how to work this program. I didn't need anybody's help. Thank you very much. And Gail and I would go to meetings together sometimes after work. And at one meeting, I heard my first sponsor speak, Ms. Claire. And you know, they always say pick a sponsor that has what you want. Well, I didn't know what I wanted. I have no clue. I'm like, I don't really know. And I certainly was not going to ask anybody. Because everybody talked about it, and I talked as if I knew. So I was not going to go back and go, I have no clue what it is to have a sponsor, and what do they do, and why do we have to do the 12 steps, because I don't really like a couple of those. I don't really want to do number four. It's not looking really friendly to me, so we need to change that. In Richmond, we have them up on the wall. That's why I'm doing this over there. So I heard Claire speak, and I liked what she had to say. I could identify with what she was talking about. I could identify with how she felt when she didn't drink. And I could identify with how she felt when she did drink. And so I would, like, watch her. Because, you know, I was one of these people that had to observe. And if you even acted weird in the least way, I was, like, awful on the side. I was like, I wasn't even going to talk to you. And she was consistent with her behavior at every single meeting. She talked to people. She came early. She stayed late. She was always smiling. And see, if people were nice to me, what do you want from me? That's what I thought. Somebody has to want something from me because nobody is going to be nice to me. Nobody is that nice. Nobody does anything without wanting something. But that's really how I was. Because every time I did something, there was a rope attached to it. Sometimes the rope was smaller than others, but there was always something that was attached to it. But I noticed that Claire wasn't really like that. So I thought, So Gail was at this next meeting that I went to, and it was a Sunday meeting at the Roundhouse. And if any of you ever have a chance to go, it's an awesome meeting, but it's about 125 people or something. It's a huge, huge meeting. Lots of people that got lots of time. If you added up all the time in that room, and I'd probably get 100 years at least. And Gail and I were talking, and by this time it's 3 months. I've been 3 months without a drink and no sponsor. I might as well have been drinking because I was nuts. And she said, have you gotten a sponsor yet? And I said, nope. And she said, what about Claire? And Claire, I turned around and she was standing right there. And I introduced myself and I said, I need a sponsor. And she said, well, why don't we talk? And I said, okay. And she was nice. And she was my sponsor for 4 years. Went through the steps. It took me a year to do my fourth step. I don't recommend that because I was pretty miserable. I was had a lot of fear, which I learned is false evidence appearing real. I had a lot of fear about doing a fourth step because I didn't know who I was. And the whole time that I was growing up, I always thought that I had, like, all these good friends. Like, you know, I had, like, 20 friends. They did not know me. They did not know Barbara. They were out here, and I called them my friend, and if they started to get in too deep, then it was like, I was gone. And I remember one of my best friends that I still have today, and I'm so grateful she's in my life. When I was in school before I got kicked out, she said to me, her father was an alcoholic and he was in AA. And Terry has, I don't know, 20 some year or something. I keep looking at John because John knows what I'm talking about. And she said to me, now she saw me through all my, through the worst part of all my drinking. And she looked at me and said in a loving way, how can you help people that are going to be out, that are alcoholics, when you're drinking like a fish and you can't even help yourself? That's what I said. She thought, how am I going to do that? And that was about as much thought as I gave it. I totally dismissed it because I didn't think I had a problem. Michelle and I are still very good friends today, and she still is as honest as she can be, and I wouldn't have it any other way. Claire and I, she was my sponsor for 4 years, and when I finally did the fourth step, Claire was one of these people that really, she has a very angelic face. And people, I think people can believe that you can get over on her, but people that know her know that is the farthest thing from the truth. And I think somewhere in the back of my sick little brain, I was thinking that, because she started talking about doing the fourth step with me after we had done the third step. And when we did the third step, we knelt in her dining room and held hands. And to this day, it was the most powerful spiritual experience I've had, one of them anyway. Because I really believed it, and I really did it. And I don't think you can fake that. I think so. I tried to, but it was just an amazing experience. Because what happens after that is I had to start doing something. I had to start into action, or as my sponsor says, putting legs on prayers. I had to start doing something. So when I did my fourth step, she gave me these, I call them the sheets, and I say it that way because to me the one she gave me was like a accounting form that was just like the columns. It's just like it was in the big book, but she had it written out and the columns and all that kind of stuff. And she said, go home and do your fourth step. And I'm like, I don't really want to do this. I don't really want to do this at all. So then I got my hands on an NA book. I don't know why. And I said, look at how they have it in here. And she's like, I don't really care. You need to do it like it's done in the big book. Because Claire was very, and still is very much, you know, big book, principle, tradition oriented, which I'm very grateful for now. So I sat down, and finally something in me just was like, I would like walk around it in my bedroom and just stare at it on the nightstand. And I would walk like this, like it was going to come get me or something. So I finally sat down on my bedroom floor and wrote it out. And when I finally did that, I could not stop writing. I just sat and it just came out. And I called her. I waited a week before I called her, which I do not recommend that either, because now that it's all out, it's kind of sitting here, and it's like if you have a big mound of poop, and it's in the middle of the floor, and if you shovel it to other places, it's still poop, and it still stinks. It's just smaller. It doesn't matter. So I still had all that junk out there, and I hadn't called her. And so I called her after about a week. I was at work one day, and I'm like, God, I don't know what is wrong with me. You know, everything was a crisis. And she would say to me over and over, you don't have to call me just because things are bad. And I thought, well, why else am I going to call you? I mean, really, that was my thought because I didn't get it. So I called her, and she said, you need to do your fifth step. And I said, really? And she said, yeah. And I'm like, oh, my God. So we met at her house, and she lived in the most beautiful part of Richmond. Lots of old, big houses that were built like back in the 30s and 40s, and she had this huge dining room. And every time I walked in there, it was like, I mean, I just felt so comfortable. And so we sat at her dining room table, and I thought I'd done this great job. And she would go, well, you know, you still got something over here you still need to work on. I'm like, what do you mean? Well, you need to write some more on this. And I just looked at her, and she goes, now? And she got up and, like, went and made tea, and I sat and wrote. And then we get to something else, and I think I was there probably 3 or 4 hours. And after we finished it, there were a lot of things that I was taking responsibility for that I really didn't need to. And there were some really bad stuff that happened to me. When I was in college, kind of digressing, when I was in college, I was drinking pretty heavily, and I was raped. I was in a blackout when it happened, which in some ways I think was a godsend because I really don't remember much of it. It was somebody that I knew. And I had that down, and I was carrying all that guilt with me. And she's like, you didn't do anything wrong. And I thought because I was intoxicated, clearly, that was, you know, if I wasn't drunk, that wouldn't have ever happened. That was my mindset. She said, that's not true at all. You know, so I had been carrying this stuff with me. I won't really say what I want to think, but carrying the stuff with me since I was 18 years old, and I was in my 30s, God knows I was still drinking over it, too. And to have somebody sit there and tell you it's not your fault, but this is, you did have a part in this and this and this, and let's see what we can do to clean up your side of the street. And I was like, you mean I don't have to take responsibility for all this other stuff? She said no. And there were people in my drinking, because even when I was a binge drinker and even when I physically wasn't ingesting alcohol, I was still dry and I still had the weird thoughts. And there was a joke that I had played on one of my coworkers at the time, which I thought was hysterical, which really wasn't. She was a very nice lady, and it was April Fool's Day, and she was really big into appearances, and so I had made up this stationery, and I had made this big letter saying that she had won this big award, and, I mean, none of it was true, because I'd made it up, and I put it in her mailbox, and she went and told my boss that she had won this award, and my boss is believing her. She went and told her husband, who believed her. The best part is that I used to work in a nursing home, and one of the ladies in the nursing home went to the same church that this lady did, and the pastor from the church was coming to visit this woman. So this lady, her name was Lois, goes up to her pastor, look what I got, and he just happened to be on the way to the printer for the little bulletin they hand out. Well, I'll put this in the bulletin. Can I get a copy of this? Of course, none of this is true, right? I made all this up. And because I saw all this was happening, I certainly wasn't going to say anything because she was going to be mad at me, and nobody knew that I really did it, so I ain't going to say nothing. There was one girl that did it with me, and she said, I'll take the fall for it because this is getting out of hand, and Lois didn't like me anyway. And I said, okay. I ain't saying nothing. Okay, you go right ahead and do it. Didn't feel bad about it, nothing. So it all comes out that I had a part in it, and I was so, I couldn't believe that she was, like, so upset about all this stuff, right? Because it was just a joke, and it was April Fool's Day, come on. Well, anyway, that relationship did not go very well, and when I was doing my fourth and fifth step, that was on there. And she said, well, what was your part? I'm like, you mean besides the fact that I totally misled about 15 people and made it up and I didn't take responsibility for it? And she said, well, what do you think we can do? And I said, I don't even know where she is. I really don't. And I don't really know if she'd be real happy to see me anyway. So she said, why don't you write a letter to her, make your amends, and then hold on to the letter. And if you ever find her and you ever see her, you can give it to her. I was like, okay. She said, why don't we do it right now? She knew me, because I would have been like, yeah, I'll do it. I ain't doing that. So I did it, and I folded it up and kept it. And, you know, God works in mysterious ways, because the job that I had that I was drinking at, there was a little place called Tackle Express that was, like, right behind there. And I would go over there, and I didn't drink at work, but I would go over there and get sodas or whatever. And I just happened to be walking over there. And as I'm coming up on the parking lot, they had like a newspaper stand, and I looked, and it kind of looks like Lois. That woman didn't raise her head. She was, you know how people are like really acting like they really don't want to see you, and they're like getting all, she was getting interested in some newspaper box or something. So I just kept walking, and I walked inside, got what I needed, came out, and when I came out, she had turned around, and we were standing face to face, and there was no way that I anyway could have gotten out of it. And she asked how I was doing, and I said, you know, I really need to apologize for the way that I treated you when we worked together. I said, that was very wrong of me, and if there's anything I can do to make that up or to do something for you, I'll be glad to do it. She said, no, just the fact that you apologize is enough. I said, well, thank you. I appreciate that. And this was a while after I had done my fifth step. And, of course, I didn't share that with my sponsor at the time, that that had happened and all that kind of stuff, because I was still really scared to let somebody know me at that point, and I had been sober, it was less than a year, I guess, at that point. And there were other people that I needed to make amends to, and I had some people that said, don't ever get in touch with me again. I don't want to speak to you anymore. I don't want to see you anymore. And so there were other things that Claire and I had talked about. There were other things I could do because, you know, she really got into, you know, you make amends unless it's going to hurt you or somebody else. Because we're not in the business of hurting other people. And if these people have said they don't want to see you, then you need to respect that. But let's see what else we can do to help with that, to make your amends, to get this off of you, and so you can take care of this. And that was my first lesson in my entire life of taking responsibility for my actions. That was the first time that I had ever done that. And situations always present themselves that give us an opportunity to do that over and over again. This job that I was still working at when I got sober, I had done my part of my internship at a residential treatment center that was owned by this outpatient facility that we had, and I had told somebody, oh, I used to work there at this inpatient place. I never worked there. I spent like a weekend every 2 weekends a month up there doing part of my internship. I didn't work there. They didn't pay me. I was not an employee. And it got back to the director that I had said that I had worked there. And now he's part of the same company that I'm a part of. Now I'm legally working there. I get a paycheck and all that kind of stuff. And he's like, Barbara never worked here. And they came back to me and said, why did you tell me that you worked there? Because you didn't really work there. And I said, well, really what I meant was, which I never said. So I called him and I said, you know, Tom, I know that I told so-and-so that I worked there, but I misspoke. I did my internship there. And I said, I just want to let you know that I'm not saying this out of step, that I know that I did my internship. But he goes, oh, that's okay, Barbara. Don't worry about it. It's fine. I said, no, I need to let you know that. And he said, well, I appreciate that. You know, and I was scared to death picking up the phone and doing that, but that's what this program taught me to do, to keep my side of the street clean. And if there's any kind of misunderstanding now, I used to love being angry because it used to give me power. I thought that's what it gave me, because then it led me to drink, which is really what I wanted to do anyway. But today, you know, I don't like being angry. I don't like the way that I feel. I just hate it, you know. I don't like it anymore. It doesn't make me feel powerful. To be honest, sometimes it really scares me when I get angry, when I get irritated, because that was a big trigger point for me. I've been sober about 3 years, I guess, and I was in a very abusive relationship and fortunately got out of it. But because I was so angry, I was at the point where I'd stopped going to meetings. My sponsor, Claire, had said, if you get back with this guy, I'm not going to be your sponsor anymore. I'm like, well, you're fine. Don't. You know, so I was out there, no sponsor, miserable, wasn't going to meet. And this person I was involved with, we'd gotten into an argument, and it was about 11:45, and I thought, I can still make it. I can still get some alcohol. And I'm driving down the road, and I remember I hadn't gotten too far from a house, and I said, Barbara, why are you allowing this to happen? This is not what you want. And I turned my car around and drove back home. And I didn't drink. And right now, it's 6:45 on today. I haven't had a drink in almost 8 years. But I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. So that's why I go to meetings. I have a sponsor. I get involved in the program now. There are things that I'm doing. Christy Ellis has been my sponsor probably for a year, maybe. Probably about a year. I had been without a sponsor for a couple of years. And I had a temporary sponsor who was a good friend of mine, and she was very clear with saying, you're a really good friend of mine. I don't want to be your sponsor, but I'll temporarily sponsor you because I know that's what you need right now. And that worked. I had a lot of women in the program that I talked to. But Christy had something that I wanted. You know, every meeting that I would go to and I would see her, she was happy. And I really felt this void in my life because I didn't have a sponsor. And I knew what it felt like before. And it didn't feel like that now. I wasn't involved in service work. I was still going to meetings, but there was just something that just wasn't right. So I asked Christy to be my sponsor, and Christy is very involved in service work. She really believes in that. She's never pushed it on me. But she said, well, you know, I did in a group. I said, please, God, don't make me do that. She goes, why? I said, I would go nuts. Please, I will clean out ashtrays. I will do coffee. Please don't make me do in a group. I can't stand that. I'm not offending anybody. I appreciate people that do it, but I know me. I couldn't handle that. So she said, okay, well, that's fine. So probably about a couple months ago, I had told her I wanted to get involved in service work. And she got me involved in service work. I'm helping her do there's a conference in Richmond this coming weekend, and I'm helping her with registration. When John and I got married at the end of April, and Christy told him at the wedding, she said, you didn't realize when you were marrying Barbara, you're also marrying her sponsor. And now John goes to the jail and takes meetings into the jail and does that kind of stuff. And that's totally his choice, but Christy presented that to him as a way of service work. And that was something that he chose to do. I was totally out of him and do with it. But, you know, and speaking at meetings is something that she really believes in. She's got, that's how Billy got my number. And I'm really grateful for her for doing that, because that's what I asked for. So sometimes, you know, I've learned you have to be careful what you ask for, because you get it. But, you know, I certainly had points in my recovery where things weren't always going as smoothly as they should. I think Claire was still my sponsor when I'd been sober about 3 years, and I remember going to her going, when does it start getting better? Because if it's like this, then why am I even sober? Because I still expected everything to change, even though I wasn't really doing what I was supposed to do. I still had that logical, you know, alkalogic thinking of, this is what I'm supposed, you know, why isn't everything supposed to get better? You know, and I was still judgmental. I was still critical of people. I was still very critical of myself. I wasn't involved in service work. I was doing things halfway. I just wasn't doing the things that I was supposed to do in the program, because I thought it should, okay, I'm sober, okay, let's go. It's supposed to all come to me, you know. And when I had to end my relationship with Claire, that was really, really hard, but it was really time for me to do that. And I found another sponsor that I got along with, but it just wasn't the same, you know. And I think from that time on, in between the time that I had Lois as a sponsor and then have Christy as a sponsor, my recovery wasn't what it is today. Now I'm involved with a group of women they're my family. You know, they are my insides. They're part of my family. You know, just being in this program taught me that you do the right thing even when you don't want to do anything. Even when you don't want to do something, you still do it because it's the right thing to do. John had a good friend of his who lost his granddaughter in a really violent car accident last week. I hate funerals. It all became about Barbara. I didn't want to go, but I went because that was the right thing. That's my sponsor family. That's the right thing for me to do. To be there to support my husband, to be there to support them and say, what is it you need for me to do for you? Because you need help right now. What can I do for you? That's getting out of myself, when otherwise I'd have been sitting at home going, God, I certainly feel sorry for him. You know, I didn't have the ability to, I had the ability to empathize a little bit, but I didn't have the ability to empathize and then do something about it. You know, here, let me cook you a meal. So all you have to do is heat it up. Let me just at least do that for you. Because that's the least that I can do for you helping me and welcoming me into the rooms of AA. You know, we went to a wedding yesterday that I didn't feel like going to either. But it was important to John that I went because he was close to these people in the program. These people in the program, and I still don't feel like going. But I went because that was the right thing to do. And I'm glad that I ended up doing that. And it's not about me being, oh, look at Barbara, and she's a great person. It's about practicing the principles in all of our affairs. I didn't realize, I've been sober a while, and I didn't realize that I could actually practice this, like, out of the rooms. I really did not get that, you know. I really didn't get it, you know. And I can remember when it finally started to click how much easier things got at work. Because I would get all whipped up about stuff at work that had nothing to do with me. Nothing. Nothing. You know, and I can remember, you know, with family stuff, you know, my aunt and my grandmother had something going between them, and I can remember getting all whipped up, and Claire looks at me and says, what does that have to do with you? And I was like, and she said, no, what is this, is it affecting you? And I said, no. She said, then you need to stay out. But I love my grandmother. You know, I had all these good reasons, but I love my grandmother, but they didn't have anything to do with you. You know, and I had a situation at work where there was somebody that I was working with, and I was kind of part of a conversation, and somebody had said something, and this girl really took offense to it, and at the time they said it, I said, well, I got a lot of work, so I'm going to go back to my office. Didn't have anything to do with what they said. And I'm in my office, and I had my back to the door, and she comes barging in my office, and she's like, can you believe she said that? And it scared the crap by the man. I turned around looking. I said, what are you talking about? Because I'd forgotten it because it was not important. And she's like going on. And I said, you know what I've learned is that 99.9% of things that happen in this world don't have a daggone thing to do with Barbara. I said, so I don't really know what you're talking about. You know, this seems like you're being sensitive about something. And the only reason I could say that is because I had people tell me that when I was in these rooms, because I always wanted to get so involved in everything, and that's what was fueling the chaos, because that's what I was comfortable with. You put me in a chaotic situation 10 years ago, man, I was happy as a clam. I knew exactly what to do. I knew how to handle it. I fell apart totally afterwards, but that was irrelevant. I didn't ask people for help because I didn't need any help, thank you very much, because the way that I grew up is if you asked for help, then that meant you were weak. A great foundation for an addiction. Didn't need any help. But being in these rooms helped me to have a relationship with a higher power and to realize that God, who I choose to call my higher power, is not something that I put in a box and put off to the side. And when I need it, that's when I take it out. That's not it. Because when I would pray, it would be get me out of and then I'll do. And it was always fill in the blanks. That's what I learned is that's not praying, and that's praying for Barbara's will. That's not praying that God's will be done. And sometimes I had to learn the answer is no. You know, I always thought everything was going to go my way because why wouldn't it? I mean, really, that's what I thought. Why wouldn't things go my way? You know? But what this program, again, has taught me is that it right-sized me. And if I do the things that this program talks about, if I stay close to my sponsor, if I have a spiritual connection with my higher power and do the steps and do what I need to do, then I'm going to be all right. And that's the bottom line. I'm going to be okay. There were times I went through more in sobriety than I did when I was drinking. And there were times that I didn't know how to handle it, but there were people that I could call upon that would help me. Or there were times that God put people in my life, because I'm a firm believer that God works through people, and He put people in my life that would help me through whatever situation there was without me really having to ask. But now, today, I still struggle, and you can ask John, I still struggle with asking for help. We're driving down here, and I'm driving, and I'm trying to get the water, you know, my water, the top off my water bottle. And John's like, I can do that. I'm like, I got it. I need you to do it. And that's just, you know, that's just part of me. But you know, it's a struggle. I have to do it every single day. I have to work at this every single day. I can't just put it on the shelf. And I've been through the time where I didn't go to meetings, and I was miserable. I didn't talk to my sponsor, and I was miserable because I thought that if you talk to your sponsor, that meant something had to be wrong. And God has put a sponsee in my life that's exactly what she does. And that's okay because I'm still there. And I talk with my sponsor about her, you know, because I call my sponsor a couple times a week. My sponsor is not somebody that says, you have to do da-da-da-da-da, because if somebody tells me what I have to do all the time, I'm not going to do it. Because I still have that part of me that don't back me into a corner. And don't tell me you have to call me every single day at this time. And there's some people that do that, and that works for them. And I say, rock on, brother, because if that works for you, go for it. And that's one of the things that I learned in this program is that not all of us are the same. And that what works for you isn't going to work for you, might work for me. And that's okay. This program taught me about acceptance and love and tolerance, and that people accepted and loved me when I was less than deserving of that. And so as long as I practice this every day, and as long as I keep in my mind I want to be sober more than I want to drink, then I'm doing all right. Thanks. Let me share.